Today on Against the Grain, it's easy to view the last 250 or even 600 years as a period of an ascendant capitalism conquering everything in its wake. But the work of historian Peter Linebaugh reminds us that resistance was present from the birth of capitalism and that working class movements for a better world have profoundly shaped our histories. In his latest book, he recuperates the lives of some of those forgotten rebels, bringing their heady world and aspirations to ours, where we need them most. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. On February 21st, 1803, Colonel Ned Despard was publicly hanged and decapitated in London before a crowd of 20,000 for organizing a revolutionary conspiracy to overthrow King George III. His black Caribbean wife, Kate, helped to write his gallows speech, in which he proclaimed that he was a friend of the poor and the oppressed. He expressed trust that the principles of freedom, of humanity, and of justice will triumph over falsehood, tyranny, and delusion. So writes Peter Linebaugh in his book Red Round Globe Hot Burning, a tale at the crossroads of commons and closure, of love and terror, of race and class, and of Kate and Ned Despard, published by UC Press. Linebaugh is the author of the Magna Carta Manifesto and the incomplete, true, authentic, and wonderful history of May Day, among many others. I should disclose my connection to PM Press, which has published several of his books. When I spoke to Peter Linebaugh, I asked him to remind us of the world-changing events that took place in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, starting around 1789.
The world-changing events were enclosure of land, conquest of land, war, steam-powered technology, coal replacing wood as a source of energy, European domination of the world, while at the same time engaging in a mighty struggle within Europe between the principles of the French Revolution and the principles of those opposing liberty, equality, and fraternity or humanity. So wherever you look around the planet or in whatever disciplines you look at, history, literature, it was a romantic period. It was a period of great changes in music with Beethoven. It was a great period of big changes in physics and biology and geology. So many, and of the state formation under Napoleon. So I think the major political event was probably the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution, or the beginning, first successful slave revolt in world history, coming at a time when those slaves, those workers, produced the most dynamic and profitable commodity for Europe, in a way a kind of useless commodity, refined sugar, that then enables Europeans to, you know, do their pastry thing and their sugar thing. It's a very active hunger suppressant, but it was responsible for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from Central and West Africa forcibly kidnapped and transported over weeks at sea to barracoons or penitentiary-like places in the Caribbean before then being shunt off in coffles or chain gangs to their plantations where they had been bought by planters. But stepping back a little bit from that, which I think we're used to thinking of in terms of atrocity, but it's important also to think of it in terms as a dynamic economic function in the world system. It becomes such that also in that period, that labor, which is now massive, it's like the first proletariat in the world, mass proletariat, shifts from sugar to cotton. And with the shift to cotton is the destruction of other cotton-producing regions, namely South Asia, the Indian subcontinent, and Egypt and the Ottoman Empire, so that the American South becomes, in that period you described, the principal source of cotton. But I say it's also the principal source of capital, which is no longer has the fluffy form of the cotton ball or the gentle touch of the fabric, which incidentally is now produced by children and women enslaved at steam engines in the English textile mills. It's important not to see this just as cotton, as I was saying, but to see it as capital, because, or to see it as money, so that this becomes a basis now of the huge changes across the globe in this rapacious dash for capital, for more money. And that money is then used to employ yet more workers against more types of machines. And let's not stop at machines. I think now we have to see that land or earth, whether it's ports or forests or deserts or coastline, becomes capital, becomes real estate. This is especially important for to understand military history, because now it becomes the conquest of the Ohio Valley, for example, where I'm most familiar with, but this principle of conquest applies all over, is used to destroy previous forms of creaturely or human existence on these different ecological zones. It now becomes just land or just real estate. So this is also capital, which is used now to employ possessionless workers to produce, you know, various commodities, resulting in, as I mentioned, sugar, liquor, textiles, wheat, bread. In other words, the period that you're describing is, in a way, the crucible of so much of what we now call, that results in globalization. So that the whole world is hooked up in what historians will call the world system, or which may equally be seen as various empires. And the period you describe is it's those wars that produce the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy is that which produces the largest imperial power, namely England. I was going to say imperial nexus, because the United States, what is called the United States, which is also formed in the same period you describe, the USA and the UK are both formed in that period. And I'm really tempted to stop and talk about that, because
sure,
both the USA and the UK are now have a dubious kind of political stability in the world. In the UK, we see this, you know, with the struggle in Ireland, with the northern part of Ireland, with the struggle in Scotland for independence. We see it also even, so that's politically. And the USA is also a instable in political formation in increasingly evident ways, with its basis in slavery, its basis in the commodity, the private property commodity form of treating what I'm increasingly calling just Turtle Island, as a, not as a winking form of referring to Native Americans, but to describing this part of human life on this continent. I mentioned the Ohio Valley. I live in Ann Arbor, which is the source is in the location of the largest freshwater in the world. And so we're very conscious of that period of history you describe, because this is when invaders came and came to appropriate, expropriate these lands where I live now. Anyway, every part of the globe has a similar story of more or less antiquity. You know, I say antiquity, it's just a couple hundred years old. So that's the story of expropriation. But with that comes new political forms, and of course, and new types of money, new types of capital, or capital as such, destroying other forms of human communities.
Tell us about the part in all of this of the commons and their enclosure, which precedes the period that you're talking about, but is central to it.
Yeah. Enclosures had been in Europe and in England had been, I mean, there are different types of enclosures. Some are needed by herding communities, you know, to divide and protect livestock. But with the macroparasites of human history, enclosure has been a way of saying, this land is mine, and just as powerfully saying, this land is not yours. So there's a positive and a negative side to enclosure. But what enclosures did in the 16th century in England was largely done by buying land. In the 18th century that I describe and work on, it's largely done by acts of parliament. And so the year 1803, you have a general enclosure bill, but generally enclosure was done parish by parish, and a separate act of parliament was required in each. So taking over land meant was done piecemeal, was done very slowly. And this is why on the one hand, there have been numerous revolts in English history, and on the other hand, why none of them has been successful. Because the enclosure of land, or the expropriation of the commons, or common lands, or community ways of using the land, were expropriated bit by bit, slowly. In the 16th century, through the market and through state requisitions, everybody knows Henry VIII took over vast amounts of land. And then in the period that you just described, 1789 to 1815 or 1817, that period also had a huge number of enclosures through Parliament, or through the Den of Thieves. This was nothing other than an act of class robbery, where landlords would seize the common lands next to them. And they would do so brutally, forcefully, of course, with an ideology of improvement or development, as they called it. I mean, we refer to economic development, they called it improvement. But what it meant, and there's a huge amount of literature on the subject, it was a vast destruction of communities and of ways of life, where people had no longer a way of living. They lost their cow, which meant they lost their milk, they lost their cheese, they lost their roast beef, they lost really a livelihood. These losses take place, but there's growing opposition to it, which largely is ignited from abroad. Because at the same time, empire is expanding. The oldest colony is Ireland. In the period that we're discussing, in the late 18th century, Africa. And so the book that I recently wrote, Red Round Globe Hot Burning, tells the story of an Irish person and an African-American person who were in love. And they touched different forms of revolt in their lives around the Atlantic world, you might say, the coastal littoral on both sides of the Atlantic, in Europe, in the Caribbean, in North America, and in West Africa. So the struggle against for the commons, against the enclosure in England, already has this international side. We no longer look at, we're used to seeing capitalism as international, but now we're seeing the resistance to it as also being international, that the colonized people of the British Empire, in the case that I described with these two people, Edward Marcus Despard from Ireland, from County Laois, and his comrade, Catherine Despard, or Kate, as I call her, call him Ned, they now figure centrally in the development of the working class in England. They figure centrally in the growing revolt against slavery and against racism, and they figure centrally in the prevention and delay of the establishment of the penitentiary, the new form, along with the factory, of exploitation. So the story of enclosure and the story of the commons must also, if you look at it over the sweep of time, must include empire and colonization.
And I should say that I'm speaking with Peter Linebaugh. He's a historian and the author of Red Round Globe Hot Burning, a tale at the crossroads of commons enclosure, of love and terror, of race and class, and of Kate and Ned Despard. And that's published by the University of California Press. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So tell us more about who these two were, Ned and Kate Despard. Out of what worlds did each of them come?
He came from a privileged world. It belonged to the Anglo-Irish ascendancy in Ireland, to a minor gentry in County Laois in the Midlands of Ireland along the River Nore. The River Nore flows down to the Atlantic, and then the waters and other life forms like the eels on the River Nore, which were a common good for those who lived along its shore, they went to the Caribbean for mating, and then returned all the way across the Atlantic. I know this isn't directly answering your question, but it was such a powerful image for me. I came across it relatively late in research. That is, how do eels get around the world? And how do they navigate? And so many of the questions that I was asking about Despard were also scientists and fisher folk ask about the eel. There are certain mysteries. But Despard came from a large family, you know, and a military family. I say they were minor gentry. He had brothers. They were soldiers. Despard himself was, he grew up not liking the Bible. Brothers were very good athletes. He himself was good at school, very good at geometry. He became a page boy for the Lord Lieutenant at Dublin Castle, the most corrupt figure in all of British Empire. Who knows what he learned there? And they sent him off, then he joined the army, sent him off to Jamaica, where he's responsible for sighting artillery batteries and things like this, because he's very talented in geometry and ballistics. But at the same time, to do that kind of work, as I describe, he had to learn and get along with a lot of different kinds of people, speaking Irish, speaking Carib, speaking pigeons of various kinds, speaking English, and working with folk from around the world to do that kind of massive labor of shifting dirt and grunt work, from which we get our word fatigue, and the army has its own use of that term. Anyway, from there he went to the Belize, he's now, or to British Honduras, as it was known then, And even before that, he was in Nicaragua along the San Juan River. Somewhere at this time, he meets Catherine, he meets Kate. And she, as I mentioned, is descendant from African people and slave people. So many, all the British imperialist ruling class men, as opposed to common sailors, generally hooked up as soon as possible with a woman who could look after him when he got sick from malaria, or do his laundry, or do his cleaning, or do his cooking. And they were violent unions. This was a part of rape and the struggle of African American women against what's really a murderous ruling class. Despard, though, and Kate had some other kind of relationship which becomes one of comrades. They even have a son together, and they go back to Europe together. And this breaks and forces apart the color line. Despard had, with Kate in British Honduras, where he was superintendent, had distributed houses and lands in what's now Belize City without respect of persons. That is equally to indigenous people, to Mayan people, to Mosquito people, to Irish, to soldiers, to African people, to people of color. He did not adhere to a color line, and this really pissed off the mahogany producer plantocrats of Honduras. And they did everything they could to get rid of him, and they succeeded. And he and she and their son and their secretary, James Bannatyne, were returned on ship to England just at the time after the French Revolution was about to chop off the king's head of France. So huge changes now. And here we have what we would call a multi-ethnic or multi-racial couple. At the same time, by the way, that Thomas Jefferson is with Sally Hemings in Paris. You know, what our imagination is to make of what Sally Hemings learned in Paris has yet to be explored. I really look forward to that. This is not incidental because the people from all over the Caribbean, like I'm thinking now of Auger, he had been in Paris, and on his way back to Saint-Domingue, or what will become Haiti, he stops in London, and here he very plausibly may have crossed paths with in the circles of someone like Edward Marcus Despard and Kate, Ned and Kate. I use this story of Ned and Kate to explore, to identify, to begin to see how powerful this many-headed hydra, this motley crew could be and was becoming. One has to see it as a working class, even though in the period that you describe, it will be riven with divisions, especially between men and women, especially between white supremacists and people of color. And those divisions are very long-lasting and have affected historiography and historians who, whatever their good intentions, for most of the 19th and good part of the 20th century, ignored this many-headed hydra, this motley crew, men as well as women. This is the importance of Ned and Kate Despard. Their relationship to the commons was one thing in Ireland, another thing in England, a third thing in Nicaragua, a fourth thing in Honduras, a fifth thing back in London. It can take forms, landed forms, it can take forms of habitation, it takes forms of manufacturing, it takes forms of subsistence, it takes forms of fuel. Just to say commons is not nearly to invoke or to understand the massive complexity, the huge, almost universal form, complex forms of life that existed very often in the harmonious relations with local ecologies, and necessarily so.
I wanted to ask you about that many-headed hydra. Tell us about the milieu of fellow radicals that the Despards, Kate and Ned Despard, involved themselves in the 1790s.
Yeah, well, many of them were become imprisoned, and so that's a source where we can learn about them. They are vegetarians, they are millenarians, they are antinomians, they are feminists, they are strike leaders, they are organizers, they are activists. These are the common people and the people of the commons. One of the most interesting is Thomas Spence. I mean, everyone's heard of Thomas Paine, but Thomas Spence was his counterpart who favored the return of every parish to the people who lived in the parish. The parish was the main unit of social life and economic life. So Thomas Spence, he liked to chalk the pavement. He liked to create ballads and sing them. These people, these common people, lived in and worked and socialized in more than 6,000 inns and alehouses, which soon are under careful surveillance and invigilation, to use a long term for police surveillance. In fact, the police are formed at this time against such these commoners. They are formed against the sailors, the artisans, the slaves, and the servants, you know, the four main categories of common people in England at the time: slaves, artisans, servants, and sailors. S-A-S-A-S. Yeah. So out of them, each are really changing, you know, owing to the relationship to capitalism, to the relationship to the gentry, relationship to the lords and ladies. And they have lots of ideas. And one of them is the return of the commons, return of land. Another is that everyone should have, that there should be a swimming pool in every parish. Another one was that everyone should be equal, not just in the eyes of their creator, but equal in life. Not just by opportunity, but by having food, having health, having water, having fuel. And we're willing to take steps to see to this. I mentioned Thomas Spence. I think your listeners can quickly look him up. And there's very good sites on the internet with his writing, to the shame of the left-wing publishing industry in England and the United States. His writings have not been reproduced in handsome volumes and accessible for us. But there are many other such people in this time. Despard is going to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and decapitated on February 21st, 1803. His wife and partner will help him to the end. 20,000 people came to witness this terrible event. It was a mass hanging with seven other people, and was a turning point, really, I think, in world history between revolution and counter-revolution. You know, now God, property, and king will reign supreme. But for a moment there, for a moment in world history, there were other roads that might have been taken. And this is, Despard was part of the Irish revolutionary movement, which itself was part and linked in various ways with world revolutionary changes. The slave struggle in Virginia with Prosser's Rebellion, the slave struggles in Jamaica, I've mentioned, and above all in Haiti. All of these were background and part of these big changes. And what helped to bring about these changes was just not just war, but with war came the technological changes. I mentioned the steam engine at the time that General Shrapnel produced his anti-personnel weapon, right at the time that Despard was hanged. Rockets were produced at that same time in order to suppress the Irish Rebellion of 1798, in which Despard and Kate had played significant roles, though not well documented, of course. So it becomes, you know, for historians, it's a tricky issue how you uncover and describe and find traces of people for whom the ruling class wish to expunge, you know, wish to make invisible, to wish to make opaque, you know, impossible for us to learn about. But Red Round Globe Hot Burning gets his title from one of the greatest of the people who survived this conservative backlash, and that was the working class poet William Blake.
Yes, and tell us about the poem from which you take the title of the book.
The poem is called Visions of the Daughters of Albion, and it's a long poem, I mean, 5 or 6 pages long. And it's an allegorical story of the Haitian revolt. It's a rape is at the beginning of it, where a planter or a white figure, white man, rapes a woman of color. And and even though this is at the heart of it, this sends Blake, as it does all, into the deepest kind of spiritual thinking. And Blake thinks that the mode of thinking that has to change. And he says, "They told me that night and day were all that I could see. They told me that I had 5 senses to enclose me up, and they enclose my infinite brain into a narrow circle and sunk my heart into an abyss. A red round globe, hot burning, till all from life I was obliterated and erased." So it's from those lines that I derive my title, because I had to ask, what is the red round globe hot burning? For Blake, it was both the human heart and the cosmos. And I'm wondering, as now in the 21st century, with the global warming, with the huge income and inequalities and class differentiations of human beings, and the destruction of fellow creatures as a result of the disastrous changes of life forms that brought about by imperialism and capitalism. You know, this red round globe hot burning perhaps pertains to us as well. I think as soon as you see the poem from which it's from, as soon as you begin to contemplate your own heart in this world with the cosmos, you can start seeing how much we have to learn from working class struggles before us. Because Blake didn't come out from nowhere. He's not a solitary genius. You know, that's like a bourgeois myth. No, he comes from an active, thinking, common people in London, in England, and throughout the Atlantic world. Red round globe, hot burning.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm joined by historian Peter Linebaugh, who is the author of many books, including Stop Thief, The Magna Carta Manifesto. His most recent book, which we're discussing today, is Red Round Globe Hot Burning, A Tale at the Crossroads of Commons and Closure, of Love and Terror, of Race and Class, and of Kate and Ned Despard. That's published by UC Press. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us about something that you touched on, which was the significance of the Haitian Revolution for this age of revolution, this period which, as you say, set in motion so many of the forces that define our lives under capitalism in the 21st century, and also reminds us of other paths not taken.
Yeah, well, I mentioned earlier the economic significance of the of Saint-Domingo or Saint-Domingue, which will become the independent first, second independent republic in the Americas, and the first successful slave revolt in world history, a revolt which began in August 1791 and will culminate at the end of 1803, the year that Despard suffers at the gallows. So he arrives in London at about the time the revolt began, and he leaves this world at about the time that the revolt succeeded. As far as Haiti goes with world history, the wealth that was produced by the slaves of its tobacco and sugar plantations seeds the Industrial Revolution in England and in Europe. By the way, I think I need to emphasize that there was a Polish brigade that fought with the Haitian slaves against Napoleon. These slaves, these former slaves, defeated three empires in that 10 years war: the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, and the French, led by Napoleon, or Napoleon's era. His son-in-law, Leclerc, and Rochambeau, the last general, could not defeat this hunger for freedom, for land, and were forced, as was Jefferson, to admit and accept an independent black republic in 1804. The significance for American history is that this was a huge inspiration for slaves and African American people in the American colonies and in the USA. I mentioned Gabriel Prosser's revolt, but also Denmark Vesey's revolt, Nat Turner's revolt. These, so significant in American history, owe their inspiration to the successes of the Haitian slaves. More particularly, more exact to the chronologies that I have been describing and of a lot of interest maybe to us now, was one way of disrespecting Haiti was to say that it was Haitian black people who brought the plague to North America. Because in July 1793, ships from Haiti bearing emigres and bearing people of color and bearing and conveying sailors also brought the yellow fever to Philadelphia, the capital of the USA. And so American racism now gets a jolt, a big hit of virulent energy by claiming that black people are the source of disease. It's not the first time that this move had been done in the history of white supremacy, but it's a major source in American history, when in fact the opposite is the case. The white leaders fled Philadelphia. They had just built a prison there, the Walnut Street Jail, and they released some of those prisoners to bury the dead. But the people who nursed the sick, nursed them through sweltering fevers, held their hands while the last breath left them, and then carted them off to graveyards, to mass graves, were none other than Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, former slaves themselves, I think from Delaware, founders of some of the most deepest and long-lasting spiritual institutions of Turtle Island, namely the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Absalom Jones and Richard Allen organized the care, the nursing, and the burial of the hundreds and hundreds of people who sweltered out and perished in the summer of 1794. And how were they thanked, you might say? They were thanked, well, Alexander Hamilton or George Washington or the other leaders of the White Republic flee Philadelphia. And these two people were segregated from white churches and had to form their own. Thank God. Anyway, it's Haiti, that's just to describe some reverberations of Haiti that I know about. But how the Haitian revolt influenced the struggle in Venezuela for independence from the Spanish Empire, how it influenced thinkers in Brazil and in what's now Colombia, is also a very significant story. Because the most despised of people from the white supremacist viewpoint, namely the African-American slave, the laborer, the slave woman, becomes a source of liberation and of carries the message of freedom through the plantations and across the continents. And the reverberations have not ceased.
Peter, I wanted to ask you about Four Creatures. You mentioned earlier the eel. How does the mole, the eel, and the goose fit into the story? And the conch?
Right. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Because I'm not a zoologist or biologist, and I don't want to look at them metaphorically. But of course, I have to look at them somewhat symbolically. The mole, for instance, well dug old mole, says Hamlet to the ghost of his father. Well dug old mole. So underground, there comes the demand for revolutionary government, for legitimacy. That's Hamlet. Then Hegel used the same quote, well dug old mole, to refer to the underground pathways and secret ways that the idea of human freedom is carried down the sweep of time. And then Karl Marx picks it up from Hegel and makes it a story of proletarian revolution that we never know when Occupy will hit. We don't know when Standing Rock will happen. We don't know when the Winter Palace will be seized. This is all the old mole at work. So that's the mole. You know, there's some side stories to that. As for the conch, and I mentioned the eel already, didn't I, at the beginning of the program, so I won't talk much there, but about their life in the Sargasso Sea in the Caribbean, and then going back to Ireland, it seems that there are these natural or animal creatures who have preceded human beings in their travels. The conch, I went down to Chiapas and landed at an ejido, very tired and exhausted, with fellow travelers, and we were parked inside a church. And on the floor, it was at wintertime, not far from Christmas time, and there were conches spread next to pines on the floor. And this is in the highlands of Chiapas, a long way from the Mediterranean. And I thought, my goodness, how easy that this magnificent creature, the conch, could find its way into the Mayan highlands, you know, hundreds of years ago. This shows what trade there was. And so I studied the conch and learned how it moved. And it moves in such a way as not to leave a trace behind, even though, of course, it moves very slowly. You know what it is. Is it just a huge, it's like a trumpet. And in fact, it was used by slaves to blast the call for insurrection. to burn down the plantation. The conch was the trumpet. It was the Marsalis, you might say, of the time. Did not have a brass instrument, but had this conch to call revolt. Then the goose, a fourth creature after the mole, conch, and eel. The goose comes into my tale and has a whole chapter to herself because of the following most popular poem ever known, which goes like this. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose who steals the common from the goose. So that quatrain definitely goes against the grain of private property, against incarceration. And it signifies the commons, and it does so through a goose. So actually the chapter I have about this, you know, gets into talking about the geese. What role did geese play in the lives of people back then? You know, aside from quills for writing and aside from nice goose down for pillows for those who could afford it, the goose also made a very tasty, if somewhat fat, meal at Michaelmas time, you know, in the fall. And what I found out was that if you study, as I did, a statistical analysis of geese theft, of goose theft in this period, most of those thefts will occur at Michaelmas, you know, in September. So I did a bit of sociology to back up and then to understand how the goose had lost her commons and how Mother Goose stories had been such a big part of children's education and in looking after geese, now were becoming just little books. So this tale goes off in directions where, just as science changes at that time, so much of our cultural and imaginative life changes too, and that's in relationship to different animals.
Peter, I'd like to end by asking you how you feel the connections can be made between our red round globe hot burning, as you put it, our time in the middle of a climate emergency, and those forces that were set in motion in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Are there any lessons or continuities that you think we can draw from what could be pointed to as sort of the birth of the Anthropocene, the massive expansion of capitalism, and the times we find ourselves in now?
Sure. I think the USA and the UK are obsolete. I think they have passed their sell-by date as armed buttresses of private property and capitalism. I think we need to find the nerve, the strength, and the forces to reclaim a commons, to build new forms of commons, and to have the vision and the strength to do this, we can see that as our ancestors, as those who preceded us did. That, I think, is the principal lessons that I get. We are in the same river of time as they were. Our global warming, the Anthropocene, or Anthropocene, as some say, as a new era of geological history, has its birth at this same time that Kate and Ned Despard fought and struggled. Coal, things underground, leave that lithosphere and enter the stratosphere. This is the source of global warming. Taking bottled energy, whether in the form of coal or petroleum, and profusely, prodigally using it smells up the entire Earth system. It stinks. It warms us and is changing conditions in ways we can hardly enumerate, we can hardly name. Though I do admire those who are beginning to trace the coronavirus to different types of forest expropriation and deforestation, where different wild foods and different animals and the pathogens that they carry with them now have to find new hosts. And lo and behold, here we are. As we destroy the planet's lungs, so by some concatenation of chain and events that I can barely sense, our lungs are being endangered. That's the coronavirus. So we're talking against the grain here in the midst of a pandemic and looking into history. You know, there's plenty of blood that flows in this river, but also we can stay afloat and looking in the past to people like Catherine Despard, who spent her life struggling against the panopticon, against the penitentiary, and succeeded to a degree. We can look to the past and find such people and gain courage from them.
Peter Linebaugh, thank you so very much.
Sasha, you're welcome.
I've been joined in this hour by historian Peter Linebaugh, author of many books, including the Magna Carta Manifesto and the incomplete, true, authentic, and wonderful history of May Day. His most recent book, which we've been discussing, is Red Round Globe Hot Burning, a tale at the crossroads of commons and closure, of love and terror, of race and class, and of Kate and Ned Despard. And I should say that PM Press has published several of Peter Linebaugh's books, and therefore I should disclose my own connection with PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.